Hello listeners, and welcome to episode 2. My name's Kavita and I'm a citizen researcher at CAMS Digital. Today we're lucky to be joined by Paul Smitten, who's a software engineer. Having studied computer science at university, Paul currently works within digital healthcare. Paul's worked on a range of projects including CBT for people with psychosis, identifying women at risk of breast cancer, and pain tracking diaries for young people and children in pain.
Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi, Kavita. Thank you for inviting me.
That's all right. So as we can see, you've worked across a range of different types of projects. And I guess I'm just wondering, what attracted you to working within digital health as opposed to other areas?
The big thing for me is I find that digital health is a way for me to make a positive difference that goes just beyond my job. I mean, we spend quite a lot of our time in work. For me, it's 7 hours a day, most of the week. That's quite a big proportion of my life. So I find it really valuable to be able to contribute to something I feel passionate about, something that I feel is worthwhile, something that I would really like to see improved. In the past, I used to work in the electronics industry, and technically that was very enjoyable, very challenging work, and it's quite demanding, quite challenging, technically very interesting type of programming. But I just felt that at the end of the day, a lot of the things I made, I didn't really feel emotionally very strongly as to whether they succeeded or not. Some of them were good. I mean, some of them were kind of safety systems for, you know, were save people's lives in some cases. But other things were just kind of, you know, toys, gadgets, things people might order without really caring about. And I just didn't feel that working on those things was the best use of my time. But working in digital health, I feel a lot more fulfilled. I feel like I can work on projects that improve the quality of people's lives, make an important difference. And I can feel proud to tell people about the work I do within digital health. So it is a real privilege to work in this sphere.
I can understand that, actually. And yeah, like you mentioned, like mental health and also kind of technology and digital health is definitely at the forefront, or should be at least, for a lot of our current agendas as well. So that's really exciting to be a part of. I guess I was wondering, what's the typical process from when you're first met with an idea to making it a reality? And I guess in particular, what part do you play as a software engineer?
Okay, so a lot happens on a project before I'm first met with the idea. There's kind of proposals and grant applications. So they're usually made by some researchers at the university. And like I said, those people who are in charge of my team. So they kind of sort everything out beforehand. They come up with the ideas, they build a proposal. And then if they're successful, they'll receive funding from a medical body that would like to see this work completed, and then probably one of the next things they do, they'll get the project managers maybe to come up with some plans and ask what resources they have available, and then they'll ask our graphic designer to start building some designs, coming up with some images of how these projects are going to look. So he might sketch out some images of maybe mobile applications or web applications. All the graphics that the users will see, they go back to the clinicians and the researchers to see if they're happy with them. So the first thing I see is when I get the completed prototypes from the designer, and hopefully most things have been agreed by then. So I'll have a list of requirements from the project manager, and I'll have some images of how it's going to look from the graphic designer. So then it's my job as a software engineer to start building the project. So first of all, I need to take a bit of time just to understand what the software is supposed to achieve, who's going to be using it, what they're going to be doing with it, what they're expecting to get back from it, so I can get an idea of how it's supposed to function, make sure I don't misunderstand anything. I wouldn't want to build the wrong thing by mistake. That'd be an expensive bit of work we'd have to have us. So first of all, it's kind of discussing with the project managers and the graphic designer what his design show, what the project actually needs to do. Next thing I probably do is probably have a think about what sort of data we're collecting. A lot of our projects, because they're based in research, they gather a lot of data. Sometimes we send that data on to clinicians or send it on to patients, whoever needs to use it. So I think a lot of our projects, they're taking data from one place and transferring it somewhere else, maybe displaying it in a different form, maybe more readable with some graphs or charts, or sorting it in a different order, or just picking out the important parts. So maybe I'll next come up with a bit of a diagram of what sort of data it will store, how the different parts are linked together, if there are like some connections, like one part belongs to something else. And I'll also at this point probably think about storing it securely, as if we're storing any patient data, then we need to be very careful to make sure that that is stored safely and securely, and there's no chance of it leaking out or falling into the wrong hands. That's the last thing we would want to happen. So after I've got an idea of how the data's looked and how that's going to be stored, I'll start thinking about what technical solutions we can use for this project. So for building like mobile applications and web applications, there are some quite common pieces of big software called frameworks and libraries. And so I'll have a look at these and think what would be suitable for displaying this, for implementing these functions. What software is our team already familiar with implementing? And I'll come up with a list of technologies that I think are suitable for a project and that will help the workflow easily and help us as we try to build it. The next step is to start doing the actual programming. So start building the project. So I'll build the database to match the data structure that I planned earlier. I'll start writing code. On our team, we work in 3-week sprints. So a sprint is 3 weeks of work. So we'll plan it at the beginning. We'll decide what we think we can achieve within those 3 weeks. And then at the end of the 3 weeks, we'll look back. We'll see how we did. We'll see if we achieved what we intended. And quite often, we'll hope to have something that we can demonstrate back at the end of the 3 weeks and say, this is what we spent this sprint building, this is what we made. At that point, we'll plan the next 3 weeks. So a typical project would be quite a lot of 3-week sprints, I guess. You know, anywhere from a few months to a year, depending on the size of the software. And obviously, we'll try and do quite a few demonstrations along the way to make sure we're on the right track, get a bit of feedback on what we've done, and hopefully reassure people that we are actually building something and that probably is going to good use. So they don't need to worry about it disappearing into a black hole. It's important to demonstrate progress along the way. And then at the very end of a project, when we've built all the software, when we've done some internal testing, when we've had some feedback, we've tried to track down bugs, fix anything we can, made some changes. Then we'll deploy it to, usually we have some that we deploy to a server on the internet that will collect the data, store it securely, make sure only the people who are supposed to have access to it. And then that will also host any web application. So people can log into a website if that's part of this application. And then any mobile applications that we've built, we'll deploy to the Android Play Store or the Apple App Store for our users to download onto their mobile devices. So that's kind of start from the start to the beginning how a typical project runs.
Wow, thank you for that. That sounds really interesting, and yeah, definitely a great idea to kind of break up into small chunks and review things every 3 weeks. Experienced rejections within your team, I guess, in terms of kind of the project ideas or how it's been developed, and if so, how have you dealt with them?
So personally, not very often. I think we're very fortunate. We have a lot of good communication and understanding within our team. I think all of the programmers try to understand something about the clinical process and what's going on that side of things. And we try to meet with clinicians and occasionally with participants or patients when that's a possibility to understand how they're using our products and what they're hoping to do with our products. And similarly, the project management staff on our team, they try to have some technical understanding and some appreciation of what's involved in programming. So I think having that kind of mutual understanding hopefully means that we make better suggestions that aren't rejected too often. As for dealing with rejections, I think having that understanding helps us understand the reasons maybe why something that we've suggested isn't ideal or hasn't been accepted. So I think if you know the reasons and it's made clear the reasons why your idea wasn't accepted, I think that's a lot easier to deal with. And I think another thing that helps is understanding that it goes both ways as well. I mean, I might suggest, oh, let's do the software this way, because I think that's the best way to do it. And perhaps a project manager will say, well, sorry, we can't do that. That doesn't really match the requirements of this project, which might be disappointing for me. But it does also go the other way sometimes. A project manager, perhaps even more often, they'll say, well, we'd like the software to do this. And I need to say, well, sorry, that's not a very practical request. And maybe we could do something similar instead. Or maybe you just need to go back and say, oh, this really isn't a practical thing to implement and we need to rethink this. So understanding that, you know, it goes both ways makes it easier to accept if rejected.
And I guess, what are your thoughts in terms of, do you think that like applications, perhaps interventions that are supporting mental health or physical health, can they be equal or better than face-to-face interventions?
I think that's a fascinating question. The very short answer, I guess, is no, of course, they can never be equal or better than a face-to-face intervention. Mm-hmm. But I think the more interesting answer is, I don't think they're supposed to be a replacement for a face-to-face intervention at all. I think that mental health applications should try to do something completely different, not to try and replace something that already is working very well or something that they're not really suited to replacing, such as face-to-face interventions. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure that an application would ever be able to pick up on the subtleties of conversation that people can detect when they're communicating face-to-face. And I'm not sure people will necessarily feel that they can open up as much or communicate as clearly and effectively with an application. But I think there are things that an app can do that a face-to-face intervention can't. And I think that's where where mental health applications, all health applications should be focusing, not on replacing the face-to-face experience. So, I mean, for example, a mobile phone app, it can be in your pocket all day long, and it wouldn't really be practical to take a clinician with you everywhere you go. But a mobile app is there for whenever you need it. If you need some information, or if you want to report something, if there's some process that will be beneficial to you, you can take out your phone whenever's convenient, whenever you feel the need, whenever you have the time available. And in that way, I think it can fulfill a role that face-to-face consultation can't. Also, applications can do some maybe more routine main tasks that allow time to be freed up for more valuable use. So one thing that we've found on our team in the past, we've had clinicians come to us and they said to us, we do these consultations with these with our participants, you know, every week, every month, every so often. We only have a set amount of time available for them. And they say a huge amount of that time they found has been asking very routine, very mundane questions. So it might be things like, what time did you get up on this day? Which days did you take medication on? Which days did you leave the house on? And they spend a lot of their consultation kind of duplicating this information, gathering information. And they've asked us to create applications where people can enter that information themselves. The clinician can see a clear picture of it before the consultation. And so then they can spend the consultation focusing on the stuff that really matters, the important stuff, the clinical stuff, not just data gathering. So I think it's great that a mobile application can actually can never equal or better a face-to-face interaction, but it can improve it by taking some of the unnecessary parts away, dealing with them in a better way, and allowing more time for interaction between the clinician and patient of a quality nature.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially you think it's important what you said in terms of it not being a replacement from what we know is already beneficial from face-to-face interactions. Yeah, it's interesting as well, because I guess a lot of people argue that we can gain so much in a face-to-face kind of therapy format, but as soon as someone leaves that room, it can be difficult to implement the things that have been discussed in real life. So it sounds like apps can really kind of make that bridge between the two.
Yeah, I think we should use every tool we have to meet the challenges we face. So, you know, consultations, medications, health applications. I think if we use all these things together, then we stand a greater chance of success.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, like you said, you know, being able to develop kind of graphs as well, so you can track changes with the data someone has kind of presented, is really helpful for a clinician. Yeah, that's really interesting. And so I was just wondering, when developing a digital health tool, how might you adapt or tailor it to suit different age groups or genders or even perhaps people with different diagnoses?
So there are a few things we use. I guess we start off with some input from the clinical team, because they have a key knowledge about the conditions and insight into the people and the personalities who will be interacting with our applications far more than we do as a software team. Our designer works to ensure that all our designs are accessible to users who might have impairments or difficulties using specific aspects of technology. Another tool that we also have available is kind of creating user personas. So this is kind of like imagining a person with characteristics who might use our application, and then trying to think, you know, how might they interact with it? How might they find problems with the solution that we're currently thinking of? But of course, I think we mentioned before, the most important thing that we do is running these PPIE groups. So that's actually gathering a group of people who are either going to be our end users or who are very similar to our end users, people who share the same conditions, same backgrounds, same characteristics as the people who will use our application, and just really seeking their input, finding out about their existing experiences, and just getting as much feedback as we can from them about how they relate to our application and what they think it shouldn't be doing, what they think it ought to be doing, and looking for ways that we can implement that and integrate it into our designs.
And so my final question, I think, is quite an important question, and it's about any advice that you'd have for people wishing to get involved in a role like yours. And I guess I wanted to ask this question because it's become quite apparent, for example, say in the field of clinical psychology, there is an overrepresentation of, say, white women taking up therapeutic roles, but then with subjects like computer science and software engineering, there is a real lack of women and people from, say, ethnic minority backgrounds. So with this in mind, what kind of tips would you give for people who are interested in the work that you do?
So for somebody who maybe had an interest in becoming a software engineer, I think for anybody, my first piece of advice would be to start off at home. It's how I started a long time ago, just, you know, trying to hack out little bits of program on my computer. And nowadays, there are really fantastic resources for anybody just to start learning online. It's easy to really get stuck in straight away, and you can learn a huge amount that way. And you can find out whether you feel you're suited to it or not, whether it interests you or not, whether this is the type of challenge you enjoy, or maybe some people will just find it very tedious and realize that it's not the sort of role for them. But I think it's great that it's really easy to just get started programming, learning to program, building your own little projects straight away. And that's just immensely valuable experience. And it's my hope that now that it's so easy to engage, hopefully this will remove what might have been more traditional barriers to entry and make software much more accessible role for everybody from a wide range of backgrounds. Great that you don't necessarily even have to get on a course or, you know, go to a school that offers this. I got one of my first jobs just on the back of some tinkering that I'd done in my bedroom with little bits of electronic parts, and it got me through the door. So hopefully this kind of democratization of learning that online opportunities bring will hopefully maybe, you know, level the barriers of entry for anybody. I do know that there are coding groups specifically tailored for the demographics you mentioned. For women, I think there's, is it Girls Code First? And also for people from minority backgrounds, there are groups for those as well. I'm not sure if there are any in the Manchester area. And I don't have any experience of those, but I imagine they would be a great place to maybe meet people with a similar background who have a passion for developing software. It'd be a great place to find out their experiences and feel part of a growing software community. In my own role, I'm very fortunate because I work at the University of Manchester. So we have very strict policy of inclusion, and all interviewers are trained, as I was myself, to avoid any unconscious bias during the interview process. And that means we can really benefit from the advantages that come from working as part of our diverse team. I'm personally very privileged to have such a kind of forward-looking and open and progressive employer, and it would be great to see the rest of the industry catch up with that kind of, you know, level of fairness and ensuring that there's access to opportunity for everybody within this field.
Yeah, I think that concludes our episode today. Thank you so much, Paul, for coming along and sharing what you get up to at work. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. We'll be right back.